Israel, one of the most militarized countries in the world, and one that has been wreaking havoc and irreparable destruction in multiple countries in the Middle East for decades, while also assassinating people it deems threats on foreign soil. Pretty ironic for a country claiming to have the so-called most moral army in the world. Killing so many civilians, however, requires a state to have an army that serves as its main pillar. Which begs the question, is Israel a state that has an army like other countries? Or rather an army state that requires all its citizens to serve in a military that shapes society and politics in the name of defending the country? Look at most of the country's prime ministers. Since 1996, the only premier who did not have a military background was Yair Lapid, who was able to hold onto his tenure as an interim prime minister from July to November 2022. All of Israel's other prime ministers, Benjamin Netanyahu, Ehud Barak, Ariel Sharon, Ehud Olmert, and Naftali Bennett, have military backgrounds. We're talking about a country where military service is compulsory for nearly all men and women over the age of 18. As Israeli forces proudly filmed their war crimes in Palestine's Gaza, how did the country's self-proclaimed most moral army, known for branding itself as an animal-friendly, egalitarian, tolerant moral army, come to be? To understand Israel today, we must revisit the true history of the Israel Defense Forces, one rooted in militancy, terrorism, and colonial ambition. At the turn of the 20th century, Europe was in upheaval with revolutions and wars. Anti-Jewish pogroms swept across the Russian Empire. While most European Jews fled westward to the United States, around 30,000 made a different journey. They headed to Palestine, then under Ottoman rule. These migrants formed what became known as the New Yeshuv, or New Jewish Community, distinguishing themselves from the older Old Yeshuv, Arab Jews who had settled in Palestine over previous centuries, mainly for religious reasons. The New Yeshuv migrated to Palestine not seeking a spiritual refuge, but rather wanting to pursue an emerging political ideology, Zionism. Rather than integrating with local communities, the new yeshuv established separate self-sufficient farming colonies, called kibbutzim. Their goal wasn't coexistence with the local population, but sovereignty. Zionism, a growing movement among European Jews since the 1880s and supported by some influential Christian figures, promoted the idea that Jews should have their own nation-state. With anti-Semitism on the rise in Europe and Russia, Zionists set their sights on Palestine. Between 1906 and 1909, the new yeshuv grew more organized. They formed labor unions and took control of land, often through dubious deals with absentee landlords displacing Palestinian communities on the ground. Small militias were created to enforce this takeover, replacing local non-Jewish laborers and guards with Jewish workers and watchmen to secure their hold. One of the earliest Zionist militias was Bar Giora, a clandestine band of armed guards whose ambitions went far beyond protecting farms. Their real aim was the creation of a secret Jewish army for a future Jewish state. Among its founding members was a young Polish migrant named David Grun. Like many settlers in the new yeshuv, he shed his old identity to forge a new one, hebraising his name to David Ben-Gurion, a symbolic move to affirm his rebirth into the Zionist project and its new colony. Ben-Gurion arrived in Palestine in 1906 and was appalled not by the disposition of Palestinians, but by Jewish reliance on Arab labor. He saw it as a weakness, an obstacle to the racial and political purity of the Zionist colony. He even used anti-Semitic language against fellow Jews he deemed unfit for the task of building the Zionist nation, dismissing those who live off the labor of non-Jews, calling them parasitic. For him, not all Jewish immigrants would do. He only wanted pioneers prepared to fight and toil. He set about raising funds to replace all non-Jewish workers with Jewish laborers and to arm settlements so they could defend their exclusivity by force. For Ben-Gurion, the dream of a Jewish homeland was inseparable from the building of a disciplined, militarized society. Alongside other Zionist ideologues, he championed the idea of the new Jew, strong, self-sufficient, rooted in the land and ready to fight. This was muscular Judaism, a term coined by Hungarian Zionist Max Nordau,
but weaponized by Ben-Gurion as a blueprint for occupation,
pursued with the certainty that it would mean war with the Arab majority. According to historian Yaron Peleg, these early Zionist pioneers were trying to rebrand the Jewish image, rejecting the anti-Semitic portrayal of Jews as weak and passive. Farming and fighting were seen as national duties of this new muscular Jewish identity. In 1909, Bar Giora evolved into a more visible militia named Hashomer, meaning the Watchman. It comprised a few dozen members who patrolled the Palestinian land on horseback, inspired by Ukrainian Cossacks and Palestinian Bedouins. They wore kufiyas and adopted local costumes to blend in. But Hashomer wasn't merely a protective force, it was also punitive. Their presence wasn't just defensive, it was meant to instill fear among local non-Jewish communities. In the early 20th century, the Jewish population in Palestine was only around 60,000, about 7% of the population. Many Russian Jewish migrants intended to return to Russia once the situation there stabilized. But then came World War I, and everything changed. At the end of World War I, the Ottoman Empire collapsed and Britain took control of Palestine under the British Mandate. In 1917, the Balfour Declaration pledged British support for a Jewish national home in Palestine. In the 1920s alone, over 100,000 Jews, mostly from Eastern Europe, arrived in Palestine. Land purchases surged, often through controversial and exploitative methods, and new Jewish settlements sprang up. Palestinians viewed this as colonial encroachment, and tensions escalated. Riots broke out in 1920 and 1921, particularly around contested religious sites like the Western Wall and the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. In response, Zionist leaders recognized the need for a more organized force. In 1920, they created the Haganah, meaning the defense, built from Hashomer veterans and Jewish World War I veterans. The Haganah became the new Yishuv standing militia, operating semi-legally and often with British cooperation to guard Jewish communities and suppress Arab unrest. Ben-Gurion, who had risen to lead the Jewish agency, publicly promoted a policy of havlagah, or restraint. According to Ben-Gurion, the Haganah would not initiate violence, it would only defend. But in private, a more aggressive strategy was being considered. As clashes persisted, some Zionists grew frustrated with both Palestinian resistance and British interference. While Ben-Gurion maintained ties with the British, others saw them as an obstacle to Jewish sovereignty, one that would eventually have to be removed by force. In 1931, frustrated Haganah members broke away and formed a more radical group, Irgun or Itzel. Led by followers of Ukrainian-born Vladimir Jabotinsky, the father of revisionist Zionism, Irgun rejected Havlagah. In his 1923 essay, The Iron Wall, Jabotinsky wrote that Palestinians would never accept Zionist colonization voluntarily, and that they must be met with overwhelming force. He ridiculed moderate Zionists like Ben-Gurion, calling them peacemongers and vegetarians. Irgun's vision was to establish a greater Israel, not just in Palestine, but extending into Jordan, Lebanon, and parts of Syria. Their opportunity came in 1936, with the outbreak of what became known as the Arab Revolt, a large-scale Palestinian uprising against British rule and Zionist expansion. Palestinian frustration over oppressive British rule, land disposition, and economic hardship due to arrival of thousands of non-inclusive Jewish migrants, exacerbated by the Great Depression, boiled over into a full-scale uprising in 1936. What began as strikes and protests by Palestinian farmers and workers soon grew into an armed rebellion. Palestinian fighters faced overwhelming odds, not only the British Army, which deployed over 20,000 troops, but also a growing force of organized Jewish militias. The Haganah and Irgun, with tens of thousands of fighters combined, supported the British in suppressing the revolt. In retaliation, the British enacted harsh counter-insurgency tactics. Entire Palestinian villages were demolished. Thousands of Palestinians were arrested or killed. The collaboration between the British and Zionist militias deepened their ties and hardened Palestinian resistance. In 1939, following the revolt and with the threat of World War II looming, Britain anticipated further unrest and issued the White Paper. drastically limiting Jewish immigration to Palestine, allowing only 75,000 Jews over the next 5 years. This was seen as a betrayal by Zionist groups, who now considered Britain, not the Palestinians, their primary enemy. The rift within the Zionist movement widened. While some still wanted to cooperate with Britain to fight Nazi Germany, others began preparing for war against the British forces in Palestine. Exiled by the British from Palestine for arms possession, Jabotinsky began building underground Jewish cells in Poland with the goal of eventually smuggling 1.5 million Jews into Palestine. His operations were supported by Avraham Stern, a Polish-born Zionist militant in Palestine. Together, they began smuggling in weapons, handguns, rifles, and explosives, and recruited an underground force of over 40,000 Jewish fighters. World War II put their plans for an anti-British revolt on hold. Jabotinsky offered to lend his fighters to the British to help defeat the Nazis. A year later, he died of a heart attack in New York, but the ideological visions he left behind would continue to shape the movement. Avraham Stern, rejecting any cooperation with the British, broke away from Irgun and formed a new militant group, Lehi, also known as the Stern Gang. His ideology was more extreme than even Jabotinsky's. Stern openly called for the complete expulsion and destruction of Palestinians, describing Jews as a master race and Arabs as a slave race. Lehi identified itself as a terrorist organization and embraced assassination and sabotage as legitimate tools of state building. In a shocking move, Stern even attempted to forge an alliance with Nazi Germany, offering Lehi's support in exchange for help establishing a Jewish state. The Nazis never responded. Stern was eventually killed by British police in 1942, but his group lived on and so did his ideology. As the horrors of the Nazi Holocaust became widely known, Zionist militias escalated efforts to flood Palestine with Jewish refugees. Ben-Gurion coordinated with the Haganah to enable illegal Jewish emigration by sea. By 1945, more than 450,000 Jews were living in Palestine. Despite their past rivalries, the Irgun, Lehi, and even Haganah, now united by urgency, set their sights on the same goal, expelling the British and seizing control of Palestine. In 1944, a devout follower of Jabotinsky named Menachem Begin took control of Irgun and declared an open rebellion against the British mandate. A wave of bombings and assassinations followed, targeting British immigration offices, tax offices, and police stations across Jerusalem, Haifa, and Tel Aviv. Lehi soon joined in on the violence. On November 6, 1944, two Lehi members assassinated Lord Moyne, Britain's Minister of State for the Middle East, outside his home in Cairo. Lehi accused him of engineering the white paper that had restricted Jewish immigration. One of the minds behind the hit was a Belarusian Zionist named Yitzhak Shamir. The British turned to Ben-Gurion and the Haganah, imploring them to suppress the attacks. What followed was the so-called hunting season, during which the Haganah arrested, tortured, and in some cases killed Irgun and Lehi members. But this intra-Zionist war was short-lived. Public outrage over the British crackdown and growing support for militant resistance among the new Yishuv forced Ben-Gurion to abandon the policy. The Haganah, Irgun, and Lehi quietly formed a united front to coordinate terror attacks against the Brits and Palestinians. Their secret alliance was exposed in 1946 during Operation Agatha, a massive British raid on Jewish settlements that uncovered documents proving Ben-Gurion and the Haganah were now collaborating with the same groups they had once denounced as terrorists. In retaliation, Irgun bombed the King David Hotel, Britain's local administrative headquarters in Jerusalem, in July 22, 1946. The attack killed 91 people, including 41 Palestinians, 28 Britons, and 17 Jews. Their attacks did not stop there. In the following months, Irgun blew up the British embassy in Italy, and Lehi carried out the first known truck bomb at a British police station in Haifa, then bombed the British Colonial Club in London in March 1947. Exhausted by global wars and mounting colonial unrest, Britain turned to the United Nations for a resolution. In 1947, the UN proposed a partition plan. 55% of Palestine would go to Jews, even though they made up just one-third of the population. Furthermore, the part to be allocated to Jews included many areas where Palestinians were still the majority. Palestinians rejected the plan, seeing it as a continuation of colonial theft. The Arab League also vowed to oppose it. The British, now eager to exit an increasingly hostile situation they had largely facilitated, announced they would end their mandate on May 15, 1948. This announcement only further escalated tensions, leading to the outbreak of a civil war between the indigenous Palestinians and the early Jewish settler colonists. By January 1948, more than 1,500 Palestinians and 400 Jews were killed in the fighting. Anticipating full-scale war, Ben-Gurion transformed the Haganah into a proper army and implemented mandatory conscription for all Jewish men and women aged 17 to 25. In March that year, Zionist leaders met in Tel Aviv to formalize Plan Dalit, a strategy involving preemptive attacks on Palestinian communities, the destruction of Palestinian villages, and the expulsion of Palestinian residents. A strategy that many historians now describe as a blueprint for ethnic cleansing. The Haganah had gotten a head start. On January 5, it had blown up the Samiramis Hotel in Jerusalem, killing 26 Christian Palestinians, as well as the Spanish vice consul. And on February 14, Haganah Special Forces had attacked the Palestinian village of Sa'sa in the middle of the night, blowing up 16 houses and killing 60 villagers. Following the formalization of Plan Dalit, Irgun and Lehi massacred at least 107 Palestinian civilians in Deir Yassin, including women and children, on April 9. They then piled up the bodies on top of each other and burned them.
אני את יודעת בגלל מי? יש יהודי אחד שיכול להגיד זה בגללו. אני פיקדתי על דיר יאסין.
המון המון ערבים היו, המון, עד שאספנו אותם. זה לקח יומיים עד שאנחנו סילקנו את הגופות.
מה זאת אומרת סילקתם אותם?
מה לעשות? לא, למה פחדנו שיבואו, יצלמו וילכלכו את השם של המדינה?
The massacres continued. On April 25, 14 Palestinian villagers were shot dead in Saqiya and others fled in terror. And on May 22, over 200 Palestinian men were executed in Tantura after surrendering and buried in a mass grave. That grave is now paved over with a parking lot.
ועל יסוד החלטת עצרת האומות המוחדות אנו מכריזים בזאת על הקמת מדינה יהודית בארץ ישראל היא מדינת ישראל.
By then, over 200 Palestinian villages had been violently depopulated, and 750,000 Palestinians, 80% of the entire Palestinian population at that time, were made refugees. Two weeks after Ben-Gurion declared Israel's independence on May 14, 1948, he officially established the Israel Defense Forces, IDF, merging the Haganah, most of Irgun, and the remnants of Lehi into a single unified army. The IDF's first mission was to fight off a coalition of Arab armies responding to the Zionist colonization of Palestine and the mass expulsion of Palestinians. Begin, meanwhile, was focused on boosting Irgun, and his hardline ambitions nearly plunged the Zionist project into civil war before Israel had even taken shape. On June 20, 1948, the Altalena, a ship that had departed from France carrying Holocaust survivors and a large cache of weapons anchored off the coast of Tel Aviv. While the shipment was formally meant for the newly created IDF, Begin demanded that a portion be diverted to his Irgun loyalists. Ben-Gurion rejected this outright, insisting on total control of the arsenal. The standoff turned violent when IDF units opened fire on the vessel, striking it with artillery until it erupted in flames. 16 Irgun fighters and 3 IDF soldiers were killed. Though Begin held back from retaliating, the episode revealed the violent fractures at the heart of Zionism's armed factions and showed that the Zionist project had come close to consuming itself even mere weeks after the Israeli state had been declared. As fighting between Israel and 5 of its Arab neighbors raged on, the United Nations appointed Count Folke Bernadotte, a Swedish diplomat, as its mediator. On September 16, 1948, Bernadotte proposed a plan for peace, a unified state between Palestine and Jordan, sovereignty for both Arabs and Jews, and crucially, the right of Palestinian refugees to return to their homes. In a letter to the UN Secretary General, Bernadotte warned, "It would be an offense against the principles of elemental justice if these innocent victims of the conflict were denied the right to return to their homes, while Jewish immigrants flow into Palestine." The proposal was made public on September 18, but by then, Bernadotte was already dead. Just one day prior, on September 17, Lehi operatives ambushed his motorcade in Jerusalem and assassinated him, along with a French military officer. The newly formed Israeli government arrested over 200 Lehi members, disbanded the group, and put several leaders on trial. Among them, Yitzhak Shamir, who had helped plot the assassination of Lord Moyne. Though convicted, he and others were soon pardoned and released. After Lehi's disbanding, many of its members regrouped around Menachem Begin, who had founded a political party named Herut, rooted in Jabotinsky's revisionist Zionism in June 1948. But Herut's rise alarmed many, even within the Jewish community. In December 1948, Albert Einstein, who had close ties with Ben-Gurion, published a letter in the New York Times along with other prominent American Jews condemning Begin and the Irgun. They described Herut as a political party closely akin in its organization, methods, political philosophy, and social appeal to the Nazi and fascist parties. Despite the condemnation, Begin's political influence grew. For 2 decades, Herut remained on the political margins. But in 1973, Begin joined forces with Ariel Sharon, a former Haganah commander who would later go on to become Israel's prime minister, and formed Likud, a broader right-wing coalition. Just 4 years later, Begin was elected Israel's prime minister. He was succeeded by former Lehi leader Yitzhak Shamir, who served as prime minister from 1983 to 1984, and again from 1986 to 1992. By the end of Shamir's tenure, Likud and the revisionist Zionist principles it championed had become a dominant force in Israeli politics, closely tied to expansionist policies. 4 years later, in 1996, the party returned to power under its new minister, Benjamin Netanyahu.
While Ben-Gurion's narrative of restraint and morality became Israel's official story, behind that curated image were systematic atrocities and a political movement that had normalized violence as a path to statehood. And the methods of the early Zionist terrorist and paramilitary groups were absorbed into the new state's DNA, with their practices codified into the state's military doctrine and ethos, and their leaders becoming the state's guiding hands. Today, Israel brands itself as a victim that's fighting terrorism and as a moral state that's upholding democracy.
Despite having killed more than 66,000 Palestinians in Gaza over 23 months, including over 18,000 children,
and despite facing accusations of genocide at the International Court of Justice, in addition to committing numerous war crimes, including bombing dozens of hospitals, targeting ambulances and paramedics,
sniping children
directly in the head, burning children alive in tents, and luring starving Palestinians to food aid centers only to open fire on them. Yet, these atrocities didn't start recently, and they're not surprising when the institution perpetrating it was built on the legacy of the very militias responsible for ethnic cleansing, assassinations, and terrorism, the IDF.